engaged in a tug of war between two subsystems, each trying to have its own way. Our emotions, for instance, are well seen as rival storms displacing each other as best they can, thwarting each other, or collaborating against yet another storm. I now think, then, that the opponent process dynamics of emotions and the roles they play in controlling our minds are underpinned by an economy of neurochemistry that harnesses the competitive talents of individual neurons. Note that the claim is that neurons are still good team players within the larger economy, unlike the more radically selfish agents, cancer cells. I recall Nobel laureate biologist François Jacob's dictum that the dream of every cell is to become two cells. Neurons vie to stay active and to be influential, but do not dream of multiplying. In this view, intelligent control of an animal's behavior is still a computational process, in the same way that a transaction in the stock market is a computational process. But the neurons are selfish neurons, as neuroscientist Sebastian Sung, 2007, has said. Striving to maximize their intake of the different currencies of reward we have found in the brain. And what do neurons buy with their dopamine, serotonin, or oxytocin? They are purchasing greater influence in the networks in which they participate, and hence, greater security. The fact that mules are sterile doesn't stop them from fending for themselves, and neurons can similarly be moved by self-protective instincts they inherited ultimately from their reproducing ancestors. So, bottom up, neuroscientifically inspired homuncular functionalism is looking better and better as a model of how the brain works, since the more chaotic and competitive computational architectures it generates are more plausible from a biological point of view. We can begin to discern the developmental processes that could build and revise these architectures, starting in the embryo and continuing into adulthood, and also see how they could have evolved from simpler nervous systems, themselves teams of less accomplished homunculi, which sorta perceive, signal, and remember. 21. The sorta operator. Why indulge in this sorta talk? Because when we analyze or synthesize this stack of ever more competent levels, we need to keep track of two facts about each level, what it is and what it does. What it is can be described in terms of the structural organization of the parts from which it is made, so long as we can assume that the parts function as they are supposed to function. What it does is some cognitive function that it sorta performs. Well enough so that at the next level up, we can make the assumption that we have in our inventory a competent building block that performs just that function, sorta, good enough to use. This is the key to breaking the back of the mind-bogglingly complex question of how a mind could ever be composed of material mechanisms. At the dawn of the computer age, Alan Turing, who deserves credit as the inventor of the computer, if anybody does, saw this prospect. He could start with mindless bits of mechanism, without a shred of mentality in them, and organize them into more competent mechanisms, which in turn could be organized into still more competent mechanisms, and so forth, without apparent limit. What we might call the sorta operator is, in cognitive science, the parallel of Darwin's gradualism in evolutionary processes. More on this in part 6. Before there were bacteria, there were sorta bacteria. And before there were mammals, there were sorta mammals. And before there were dogs, there were sorta dogs, and so on. We need Darwin's gradualism to explain the huge difference between an ape and an apple, and we need Turing's gradualism to explain the huge difference between a humanoid robot and a hand calculator. The ape and the apple are made of the same basic ingredients, differently structured and exploited in a many-level cascade of different functional competences. There is no principal dividing line between a sorta ape and an ape. Both the humanoid robot and the hand calculator are made of the same basic, unthinking, unfeeling Turing bricks. But as we compose them into larger, more competent structures, which then become the elements of still more competent structures at higher levels, we eventually arrive at parts so sorta intelligent that they can be assembled into competences that deserve to be called comprehending. We use the intentional stance to keep track of the beliefs and desires, or sorta beliefs and sorta desires Of the sorta rational agents at every level from the simplest bacterium through all the discriminating, signaling, comparing, remembering circuits that comprise the brains of animals from starfish to astronomers. There is no principled line above which true comprehension is to be found, even in our own case. The small child sorta understands her own sentence, "Daddy is a doctor," and I sorta understand E equals MC squared. Some philosophers resist this anti-essentialism, see chapter 43. Either you believe that snow is white, or you don't. Either you are conscious, or you aren't. Nothing counts as an approximation of any mental phenomenon. It's all or nothing. And to such thinkers, the powers of minds are insoluble mysteries because minds are perfect, and perfectly unlike anything to be found in mere material mechanisms. 22. Wonder Tissue. In his excellent book on Indian street magic, Net of Magic, Wonders and Deceptions in India, Lee Siegel, 1991, writes, "I'm writing a book on magic," I explain, and I'm asked, "Real magic?" By real magic, people mean miracles, thaumaturgical acts, and supernatural powers. "No," I answer, "conjuring tricks, not real magic." Real magic, in other words, refers to the magic that is not real, while the magic that is real, that can actually be done, is not real magic. Page 425. Real magic is, by definition, you might say, miraculous, a violation of the laws of nature. Many people want to believe in real magic. When the amazing Randy, magician, skeptic, and Ghostbuster Supreme, duplicates the tricks of self-styled psychics such as Uri Geller, he is showing that the startling effects are not real magic. They are conjuring. But this doesn't convince some people. Violation of the laws of nature. Many people want to believe in real magic. When the amazing Randy, magician, skeptic, and Ghostbuster Supreme, duplicates the tricks of self-styled psychics such as Uri Geller, he is showing that the startling effects are not real magic. They are conjuring. But this doesn't convince some people. At the question and answer session following a performance in Winnipeg many years ago, a member of the audience charged Randy with a double deception. He was just as much a real psychic as Geller. He just pretended to be a mere conjurer, exposing Geller's duplicity so he could ride Geller's more famous coattails to fame and fortune. It's hard to rebut that weird challenge, except by teaching everybody in the audience exactly how the tricks are done, which Randy, honoring the tradition of magicians around the world, is reluctant to do. Penn and Teller have pioneered routines that do expose the secret mechanics of magic tricks, and after enduring condemnation by some of their fellow magicians, they have shown how the traditional taboo can be violated without spoiling the magic show. A similar eagerness to believe in real magic afflicts many people when the topic is the relationship between the mind and the brain. Some people, including not a few neuroscientists and psychologists and philosophers, are at least subliminally attracted to the idea that somehow or other, the dynamic properties of neural tissue can do something you might call miraculous, something that harnesses hidden forces undreamed of by science. Maybe they're right, but we mustn't assume that they are from the outset. The rule has to be no wonder tissue. Here is something we know with well-nigh perfect certainty. Nothing physically inexplicable plays a role in any computer program. No heretofore unimagined force fields, no mysterious quantum shenanigans, no élan vital. There is certainly no wonder tissue in any computer. We know exactly how the basic tasks are accomplished in computers, and how they can be composed into more and more complex tasks. And we can explain these constructed competences with no residual mystery. So, although the virtuosity of today's computers continues to amaze us, the computers themselves, as machines, are as mundane as can openers. Lots of prestidigitation, but no real magic. This is a valuable fact, so valuable that it will get a detailed demonstration in the next section. Its value lies in the fact that any time we can make a computer do something that has seemed miraculous, we have a proof that it can be done without wonder tissue. Maybe the brain does it another way, maybe even with wonder tissue. Maybe Randy is a real psychic just like Geller, but we have no good reason to believe it. Computers thus play an important role as demystifiers, and that is a good reason to insist on developing computer models of anything we are trying to understand, whether it be hurricanes or housing bubbles or HIV or human consciousness. The term wonder tissue is a thinking tool along the lines of a policeman's billy club. You use it to chastise, to persuade others not to engage in illicit theorizing. And like a billy club, it can be abused. It is a special attachment for the thinking tool Occam's razor, and thus enforces a certain scientific conservatism, which can be myopic. I owe my favorite example of this to William Bateson, one of the fathers of modern genetics, and here's what he had to say not so long ago, in 1916. The properties of living things are in some way attached to a material basis, perhaps in some special degree to nuclear chromatin, chromosomes. And yet, it is inconceivable that particles of chromatin, or of any other substance, however complex, can possess those powers which must be assigned to our factors or gens, genes. The supposition that particles of chromatin, indistinguishable from each other and indeed almost homogeneous under any known test, can by their material nature confer all the properties of life, surpasses the range of even the most convinced materialism. Page 91. He just could not imagine DNA. The idea that there might be 3 billion base pairs in a double helix inside every human cell was simply not within the scope of his imagination. Fortunately, other biologists didn't share Bateson's pessimism, and they went on to discover just how the apparently miraculous feat of transmitting genetic information from generation to generation is achieved by some pretty fantastic molecules. But along that path of discovery, they held themselves to the rule, no wonder tissue. They knew, from genetics, a lot about the competences their quarry had to possess, and they set their task as the construction of a physically possible model of something that would have those competences. We face a similar task today. Experimental psychology is giving us an ever more detailed catalog of the competences and frailties of the mind, the triumphs of perception, and the embarrassments of illusion, the pace of language learning, and the conditions of distraction, lust, fear, and mirth, and now, as convinced materialists, we need to figure out how on earth the brain does it all without postulating wonder tissue. As our understanding grows, what counts as wonder tissue shifts. When connectionist and other neural network models burst on the scene in the mid-1980s, they demonstrated learning capabilities and pattern recognition powers that nobody would have dared postulate in small tracts of neurons a few years earlier. We still don't know exactly how, or even if, the brain exploits the computational powers exhibited by these semi-realistic models, but it is now okay to postulate a connectionist competence for some neural network that you can't yet explain as long as you are upfront about it, and the competence is not clearly beyond the demonstrated range of feats. Randy may not do the trick the very same way Geller does, but we are safe in concluding that there is some variation of Randy's method that explains Geller's ability, which gives us guidance in inquiring further into the processes that are actually involved. The main objection to wonder tissue is that it does not give us a way of solving the problem, but a way of giving up, of assuming that it is a mystery that can never be solved. 23. Trapped in the robot control room. Robots have no wonder tissue in them, by definition, in effect. So they provide an antiseptically clean platform for thought experiments, such as this one. You wake up one morning to find yourself in an unfamiliar bed in a strange windowless room. Two of its walls are covered with tiny blinking lights of various colors, and the other two are covered with thousands of push buttons. There are numbers on the lights and buttons, but no labels. Somebody has left you a note on the bedside table. Good morning. You were drugged and kidnapped while you slept and brought here to your new home. There is food in the fridge and a bathroom in the corner, so your local bodily needs will all be met. You are imprisoned in the control room of a giant robot. Each light, when it turns on, provides rich and relevant information about the robot's circumstances. These lights are all outputs from highly sophisticated neural net analyzers of the raw inputs streaming from the robot's high-definition video eyes and microphone ears, touch sensors, and olfactory sensors. The buttons initiate robotic actions, all coordinated and ready to execute. The robot inhabits a dangerous world with many risks and opportunities. Its future lies in your hands, and so, of course, your own future as well depends on how successful you are in piloting your robot through the world. If it is destroyed, the electricity in this room will go out, there will be no more food in the fridge, and you will die. Good luck! This is a nasty predicament. With your heart in your mouth, you start experimenting, pushing buttons to see what happens. You push the yellow button numbered 4328, and notice that when you do, the blue light numbered 496 flickers out. Were you scratching the robot's itch or closing the robot's eyes or maybe eating something, thereby satisfying the robot's pressing metabolic needs? You push button 4328 a second time, and a different scattering of lights turn on. What has changed in the world? What does this mean? This is tantalizing because you have been told that there is a tremendous amount of information in those lights. But which light signals which information, and which button orders which robotic action? If only the lights and buttons were labeled. Then, if the labels were in a language you understood, you might be able to solve the problem. Or if only there were a window in the room that you could open, so you could look out and see what moved when you pushed a button. Does the robot have arms and legs? With a window, you could try to correlate events in the outside world with the flashing lights on the walls. Without a window, you have all this information ready at hand, but no way to interpret it. You have hundreds of robotic actions to set into motion, but no way of figuring out what effects they can achieve in the world. It appears that you are in an impossible situation. However clever and imaginative you are, you won't be able to figure out the meanings of the events occurring on the walls of your room, given all the data at your disposal. But if you can't solve this problem, we have something approaching a paradox, because your predicament here is none other than your brain's predicament. It is trapped in a windowless room, your skull, with millions of input lines positively humming with information about the external world and your bodily circumstances, and millions of output lines poised to stimulate muscles into contraction or relaxation. And your brain can't open a window in your skull and look out to see what's happening that might be causing the patterns of signals streaming into your visual cortex. What good would such a window be for your brain in any case? Unlike you, it has no eyes, in addition to the eyes whose signals it is receiving and trying to interpret, and no prior memories of what things in the world look like. Perhaps, you may think, the brain's task is made easier by the fact that the pattern of excitation, the blinking lights, on the surface of the visual cortex when you're looking at a duck, for example, is actually shaped like a duck. This would be fine if we could suppose your brain had learned, as you have, what a duck looks like. But how is your brain ever going to learn that? How can your brain learn anything if it first has to decode all its signals? And decode those signals into what? Turkish? Printed labels in Turkish mean nothing to you unless you understand Turkish. Does your brain have to understand a language before it can derive any value from its input? As we have already seen, this idea that brains come equipped with an internal language that they never have to learn, mentalese or the language of thought, Fodor, 1975-2008, is tantalizing. It seems to be a step in the right direction. But until the details are provided about how it works and how it evolved in the first place, declaring that there is such a language of thought is just renaming the problem without solving it. We know that the brain solves the problem somehow. Our brains do manage quite reliably to find the appropriate outputs to cope with the predicaments and opportunities the input information heralds. And we know that the brain's solution, whatever it is, can't be just like a language, like English or Turkish, since it isn't acquired in childhood the way we acquire our native tongues. Would it be more like a written language, with memories duly inscribed in the brain's archives, or a purely spoken language? Does it have a vocabulary of thousands or millions or billions of words? Does word order matter? Is there a grammar? Can one part of the brain misunderstand another part's message? If the language of thought hypothesis postulates a homunculus in the control room who understands the language, like you in the giant robot reading the labels on lights and buttons, it merely postpones the task of figuring out how learning and comprehension can be composed out of machinery consisting of uncomprehending parts. And if it doesn't postulate a homunculus who decodes the messages, then the system, whatever it is, isn't much like a language after all. And since nobody has yet come up with the details of how such a language of thought would work, or get installed during development and experience, it is probably better not to kid ourselves, not to lull ourselves into thinking we are making progress when we probably aren't. This intuition pump shows us that your brain is importantly not in the same predicament you would be in, trapped in the control room. Its task is, must be, partly solved in advance by the way some inputs are wired up to some outputs, so that there is some leverage in the brain with which to learn and refine further appropriate relationships. This is another way of dramatizing the widely recognized claim that our brains are not blank slates at birth, Pinker, 2002, but are already designed by natural selection to embody various preferences, anticipations, and associations. And as long as some of the appropriate connections are built in, they don't have to be labeled. Before there can be comprehension, there has to be competence without comprehension. This is nature's way. Bacteria have all sorts of remarkable competences that they need not understand at all. Their competences serve them well, but they themselves are clueless. Trees have competences whose exercise provides benefits to them, but they don't need to know why. The process of natural selection itself is famously competent, a generator of designs of outstanding ingenuity and efficacy, without a shred of comprehension. Comprehension of the kind we human adults enjoy is a very recent phenomenon on the evolutionary scene, and it has to be composed of structures whose competence is accompanied by, enabled by, a minimal sort of semi-comprehension or pseudo-comprehension, the kind of hemi-semi-demi-comprehension enjoyed by fish or worms. These structures are designed to behave appropriately most of the time without having to know why their behavior is appropriate. The alternative, putting a full-fledged comprehender in the control room confronted by all the inputs and outputs, is a guaranteed dead end. Why? Because if this power of comprehension is inexplicable, you have installed wonder tissue, a miracle at the base of your theory, and if it is explicable, in terms of processes and activities and powers that do not themselves have the power of comprehension, you have wasted your turn and are right back at the beginning with those of us who are trying to explain how comprehension grows out of competence. 4. An interlude about computers. Time out. As you have probably noticed, I have mentioned computers quite a bit already, and there is much more computer lore to come. Computers are without a doubt the most potent thinking tools we have, not just because they take the drudgery out of many intellectual tasks, but also because many of the concepts computer scientists have invented are excellent thinking tools in their own right. We are all swimming in the flood of computer jargon these days, software and hardware, bandwidth and gigahertz, and surely most of you have absorbed fairly accurate impressions about what the new buzzwords mean. I have discovered, however, that although my students nod knowingly when I deploy such terms in my classes, their comprehension is uneven, and they sometimes confound me by arriving at weird misunderstandings of what I was trying to convey to them. So I am going to teach you how to write programs for the world's simplest computer. If you take the time and effort now to master a few basic skills, it will pay off handsomely in deepening your understanding of what follows. And if you are already a seasoned computer professional, you might find some of my ways of explaining the issues useful when talking to non-experts, or you can skip ahead. I have test flown what follows on hundreds of computer-phobic undergraduates with happy results. Even those who would rather memorize a page of the phone book than solve a puzzle acknowledge the pleasure, the tingle of satisfaction in making this idiotically simple computer do its stuff. And when you complete the exercise, you will have been initiated into the 7 secrets of computer power. 24. The 7 secrets of computer power revealed. Computers have powers that in early centuries would have seemed miraculous, real magic. But although many computer programs are dauntingly complicated, all of them are composed of steps that are completely explainable in very simple terms. There is no room for mysteries in what computers do. That very fact is part of the value of computers as thinking tools, and explaining, in outline, how this works is philosophically interesting in its own right. How computers do their magic is well worth understanding at an elementary level. This chapter provides that demystification. We start by considering what is probably the simplest imaginable computer, a register machine, to see just what its powers are and why. We will then go on to see how a Turing machine and a von Neumann machine, such as your laptop, are just like register machines, only more efficient. Anything your laptop can do, a register machine can do. But don't hold your breath, it might take centuries. Then we can understand how other computer architectures could further multiply the speed and capacity of our basic machine, the register machine. The architecture of the human brain is, of course, one of the most interesting and important architectures to consider. Hang on. Am I claiming that your brain is just a gigantic computer? No. Not yet, in any case. I am pointing out that if your brain is a gigantic computer, then there will be a way of understanding all its activities with no residual mysteries, if only we can find it. Our method will be reverse engineering, studying a complicated system to uncover how it does what it does. Reverse engineering tells us how the heart executes its duties as a pump, and how the lungs gather oxygen and expel carbon dioxide. Neuroscience is the attempt to reverse engineer the brain. We know what brains are for anticipating and guiding and remembering and learning, but now we need to figure out how they accomplish all this. This is a topic of passionate controversy. The novelist Tom Wolfe, 2000, pinpointed the tender spot around which the battles rage with the title of his essay, "Sorry, But Your Soul Just Died." If we are to explore this dangerous territory and not just waste everybody's time with declamations and denunciations, we need some sharper tools. We need to know what computers can do and how they do it before we can responsibly address the question of whether or not our brains harbor and exploit incomprehensible or miraculous phenomena beyond the reach of all possible computers. The only satisfactory way of demonstrating that your brain isn't, couldn't be, a computer would be to show either, one, that some of its moving parts engage in sorts of information handling activities that no computers can engage in, or, two, that the simple activities its parts do engage in cannot be composed, aggregated, orchestrated computer fashion into the mental feats we know and love. Some experts, not just philosophers, but neuroscientists, psychologists, linguists, and even physicists, have argued that the computer metaphor for the human brain-mind is deeply misleading, and, more dramatically, that brains can do things that computers can't do. Usually, but not always, these criticisms presuppose a very naive view of what a computer is or must be, and end up proving only the obvious and irrelevant truth that brains can do lots of things that your laptop can't do, given its meager supply of transducers and effectors, its paltry memory, its speed limit. If we are to evaluate these strong skeptical claims about the powers of computers in general, we need to understand where computer power in general comes from and how it is or can be exercised. The brilliant idea of a register machine was introduced at the dawn of the computer age by the logician Hao Wang, 1957, a student of Kurt Gödel's, by the way, and a philosopher. It is an elegant tool for thinking, and you should have this tool in your own kit. It is not anywhere near well as known as it should be. A register machine is an idealized, imaginary, and perfectly possible computer that consists of nothing but some finite number of registers and a processing unit. The registers are memory locations, each with a unique address: register 1, register 2, register 3, and so on, and each able to have as contents a single integer, 0, 1, 2, 3. You can think of each register as a large box that can contain any number of beans, from 0 to whatever, however large the box is. We usually consider the boxes to be capable of holding any integer as contents, which would require infinitely large boxes, of course. Very large boxes will do for our purposes. The processing unit is equipped with just three simple competences, three instructions it can follow in stepwise, one-at-a-time fashion. Any sequence of these instructions is a program, and each instruction is given a number to identify it. The three instructions are end, that is, it can stop or shut itself down. Increment, register N. Add 1 to the contents of register N, put a bean in box N, and go to another step, step M. Decrement register N. Subtract 1 from the contents of register N, remove 1 bean from box N, and go to another step, step M. The decrement instruction works just like the increment instruction, except for a single all-important complication. What should it do if the number in register N is 0? It cannot subtract 1 from this. Registers cannot hold negative integers as contents. You can't take a bean out of an empty box. So stymied, it must branch. That is, it must go to some other place in the program to get its next instruction. This requires every decrement instruction to list the place in the program to go to next if the current register has content 0. So, the full definition of decrement is decrement register N. Subtract 1 from the contents of register N, if you can, and go to step M. Or, if you can't decrement register N, branch to step P. Here then is our inventory of everything a register machine can do, with handy short names, end, inc, and deb, for decrement or branch. At first glance, you might not think such a simple machine could do anything very interesting. All it can do is put a bean in the box or take a bean out of the box, if it can find one, and branch to another instruction if it can't. In fact, however, it can compute anything any computer can compute. Let's start with simple addition. Suppose you wanted the register machine to add the contents of one register, let's say register 1, to the contents of another register, register 2. So if register 1 has contents, 3, and register 2 has contents, 4, we want the program to end up with register 2 having contents, 7, since 3 plus 4 equals 7. Here is a program that will do the job written in a simple language we can call RAP, for Register Assembly Programming. Program 1. Add 1, 2. Step 1. Instruction, deb. Register 1. Go to step 2. Branch to step 3. Step 2. Instruction, inc. Register 2. Go to step 1. Step 3. Instruction, end. The first two instructions form a simple loop, decrementing register 1 and incrementing register 2 over and over until register 1 is empty, which the processing unit notices and thereupon branches to step 3, which tells it to halt. The processing unit cannot tell what the content of a register is except in the case where the content is 0. In terms of the beans in boxes image, you can think of the processing unit as blind, unable to see what is in a register until it is empty, something it can detect by groping. But in spite of the fact that it cannot tell, in general, what the contents of its registers are, if it is given program 1 to run, it will always add the content of register 1, whatever number is in register 1, to the content of register 2, whatever number is in register 2, and then stop. Can you see why this must always work? Go through a few cases to make sure. Here is a striking way of looking at it. The register machine can add two numbers together perfectly without knowing which numbers it is adding, or what numbers or what addition is. Exercise 1. A. How many steps will it take the register machine to add 2 plus 5 and get 7, running program 1, counting end as a step? B. How many steps will it take to add 5 plus 2? What conclusion do you draw from this? There is a nice way to diagram this process in what is known as a flow graph. Each circle stands for an instruction. The number inside the circle stands for the address of the register to be manipulated, not the content of a register, and plus stands for inc, and minus stands for deb. The program always starts at alpha and stops when it arrives at omega. The arrows lead to the next instruction. Note that every deb instruction has two outbound arrows, one for where to go when it can decrement, and one for where to go when it can't decrement. because the contents of the register is zero, branching on zero. Now, let's write a program that simply moves the contents of one register to another register. Program 2. Move 4, 5. Step 1. Instruction, deb, register 5, go to step 1, branch to step 2. Step 2. Instruction, deb, register 4, go to step 3, branch to step 4. Step 3. Instruction, inc, register 5, go to step 2. Step 4. Instruction, end. The first loop in this program cleans out register 5 so that whatever it had as content at the beginning won't contaminate what is built up in register 5 by the second loop, which is just our addition loop, adding the content of register 4 to the zero in register 5. This initializing step is known as zeroing out the register, and it is a very useful standard operation. You will use it constantly to prepare registers for use. A third simple program copies the content of one register to another register, leaving the original content unchanged. Consider the following program. Program 3. Copy 1-3. Step 1. Instruction, deb, register 3. Go to step 1, branch to step 2. Step 2. Instruction, deb, register 4. Go to step 2, branch to step 3. Step 3. Instruction, deb, register 1, go to step 4, branch to step 6. Step 4, instruction inc, register 3, go to step 5. Step 5, instruction inc, register 4, go to step 3. Step 6, instruction deb, register 4, go to step 7, branch to step 8. Step 7, instruction inc, register 1, go to step 6. Step 8. Instruction. End. This is certainly a roundabout way of copying, since we do it by first moving the contents of register 1 to register 3, while making a duplicate copy in register 4, and then moving that copy back into register 1. But it works. Always. No matter what the contents of registers 1, 3, and 4 are at the beginning, when the program halts, whatever was in register 1 will still be there, and a copy of that content will be in register 3. If the way this program works isn't dead obvious to you yet, get out some cups for registers. Pencil a number on each cup, its address, and a pile of pennies or beans, and hand simulate the whole process. Put a few pennies in each register and make a note of how many you put in register 1 and register 3. If you follow the program slavishly, when you finish, the number of pennies in register 1 will be the same as it was at first, and the same number will now be in register 3. It is very important that you internalize the basic processes of the register machine, so you don't have to think hard about them, because we're going to be exploiting this new talent in what follows. So take a few minutes to become a register machine, the way an actor can become Hamlet. I find that some of my students lapse into a simple error. They imagine that when they decrement a register, they have to put that penny, the one they just took from register N, in some other register. No. Decremented pennies just go back in the big pile, your infinite supply of pennies to use in this simple adding and subtracting routine. With moving, copying, and zeroing out in our kit, we are ready to go back to our addition program and improve it. Program 1 puts the right answer to our addition problem in register 2. But in the process, it destroys the original contents of registers 1 and 2. We might want to have a fancier addition program that saves these values for some later use while putting the answer somewhere else. So let's consider the task of adding the content of register 1 to the content of register 2, putting the answer in register 3, and leaving the contents of registers 1 and 2 intact. We can analyze the loops to see what each does. First, we zero out the answer register, register 3, and then we zero out a spare register, register 4, to use as a temporary holding tank or buffer. Then we copy the content of register 1 to both registers 3 and 4, and move that content back from the buffer to 1, restoring it, and in the process, zeroing out register 4 for use again as a buffer. Then we repeat this operation using register 2, having the effect of adding the content of register 2 to the content we'd already moved to register 3. When the program halts, buffer 4 is empty again. The answer is in register 3, and the two numbers we added are back in their original places, registers 1 and 2. This 13-step wrap program puts all the information in a form that the processing unit can read. Program 4. Non-destructive add 1, 2, 3. Step 1. Instruction, deb, register 3, go to step 1, branch to step 2. Step 2. Instruction, deb, register 4, go to step 2, branch to step 3. Step 3. Instruction, deb, register 1, go to step 4, branch to step 6. Step 4. Instruction inc, register 3, go to step 5. Step 5. Instruction inc, register 4, go to step 3. Step 6. Instruction deb, register 4, go to step 7, branch to step 8. Step 7. Instruction inc, register 1, go to step 6. Step 8. Instruction deb, register 2, go to step 9, branch to step 11. Step 9. Instruction inc, register 3, go to step 10. Step 10. Instruction inc, register 4, go to step 11. Step 11. Instruction deb, register 4, go to step 12, branch to step 13. Step 12. Instruction inc, register 2, go to step 11. Step 13. Instruction end. I am not going to recommend that you simulate this program by hand with the cups and pennies. Life is short, and once you have internalized the basic processes in your imagination, you can now take advantage of a prosthetic device, Rodrigo, a register machine you can download from sites.tufts.edu/Rodrigo. There are both PC and Mac versions of Rodrigo available to run on your computer. We developed this thinking tool more than 20 years ago at the Curricular Software Studio, and hundreds of students and others have used it to become fluent register machine thinkers. You can type in your rap programs and watch them run with either beans or numbers in the registers. There are also animated PowerPoint demonstrations of the path taken by the processing unit through the Flowgraph 4 edition, for instance, so you can see exactly how wrap instructions correspond to the circles in the Flowgraph. Now let's turn to subtraction. Imagine a Flowgraph for subtracting the content of register 2 from the content of register 1, putting the answer in register 4. This will only work when the content of register 1 is greater than the content of register 2. But what if this isn't so? Register 1 will zero out halfway through one pass in the subtraction loop before it can finish the subtraction. What should happen then? We can't just ask the computer to end, for this leaves the wrong answer, 0, in register 4. We can use this zeroing out to start a new process, which first backs up half a loop and undoes the provisional decrementing from register 2. At this point, the content of register 2, not register 1, gives the right answer if we interpret it as a negative number. So you can simply move that content to register 4, which is already zeroed out, and put a sign somewhere indicating that the answer is a negative number. The obvious thing to do is to reserve a register for just this task. Let's say register 3. Zero it out at the beginning, along with register 4, and then have the program put a flag in register 3 as the sign of the answer, with 0 meaning positive and 1 meaning negative. You can put comments explaining what each step or loop does in your rap programs, in between pound marks. They are for you and other human beings. Rodrigo will ignore them. With addition and subtraction under our belts, multiplication and division are easily devised. Multiplying n times m is just adding n to itself m times. So we can instruct the computer to do just that using one register as a counter, counting down from m to 0 by decrementing once each time the addition loop is completed. Exercise 2. A. Draw a flow graph and write the wrap program for multiplying the content of register 1 by the content of register 3 putting the answer in register 5. B. Optional. By copying and moving, improve the multiplier you created in problem A. When it stops, the original contents of register 1 and register 3 are restored so that you can easily check the inputs and outputs for correctness after a run. C. Optional. Draw a flow graph and write a wrap program that examines the contents of register 1 and register 3 without destroying them and writes the address, 1 or 3, of the larger content in register 2, and puts 2 in register 2 if the contents of register 1 and 3 are equal. After this program has executed, the contents of register 1 and register 3 should be unchanged, and register 2 should say if their contents are equal, and if not, which of those two registers has the larger content. Division, similarly, can be done by subtracting the divisor over and over again from the dividend and counting up the number of times we can do that. We can leave the remainder, if any, in a special remainder register. But here we must be careful to add one crucial safety measure. We mustn't divide by zero. Must we? So before any division starts, we should run a simple check on the divisor by trying to decrement it. If we can decrement it, we should increment it just once, restoring it to its proper value, and then proceed with the division. If we hit zero, however, when we try to decrement it, we need to raise an alarm. We can do this by reserving a register for an error flag. A 1 in register 5 can mean, tilt, I've just been asked to divide by 0. Picture a flow graph for dividing the content of register 1 by the content of register 2, putting the answer in register 3, the remainder in register 4, and highlighting register 5 for an error message. A 1 means, I was asked to divide by 0. Walk through the flow graph and notice how 0 in the divisor aborts the operation and raises a flag. Notice, too, that register 4 is doing double duty, serving not only as a copy of the divisor, or restoring the divisor for each successive subtraction, but also as a potential remainder register. If register 1 zeroes out before register 4 can dump its content back into register 2 for another subtraction, that content is the remainder, right where it belongs. Secret 1. Competence without comprehension. Something, for example a register machine, can do perfect arithmetic without having to comprehend what it is doing. The register machine isn't a mind. It comprehends nothing, but it sorta comprehends three simple things: ink, deb, and end. In the sense that it slavishly executes these three instructions whenever they occur. They aren't real instructions, of course. They are sorta instructions. They look like instructions to us, and the register machine executes them as if they were instructions, so it's more than handy to call them instructions. As you can now see, deb, decrement or branch, is the key to the power of the register machine. It is the only instruction that allows the computer to notice, sorta notice, anything in the world, and use what it notices to guide its next step. And in fact, this conditional branching is the key to the power of all stored program computers, a fact that Ada Lovelace recognized back in the 19th century when she wrote her brilliant discussion of Charles Babbage's analytical engine, the prototype of all computers. Assembling these programs out of their parts can become a rather routine exercise once we get the hang of it. In fact, once we have composed each of the arithmetic routines, we can use them again and again. Suppose we numbered them so that add was operation 0 and subtract was operation 1, multiply was operation 2, and so forth. Copy could be operation 5, move could be operation 6, and so on. Then we could use a register to store an instruction by number. Exercise 3, optional. Draw a flow graph and write a wrap program that turns a register machine into a simple pocket calculator as follows. A. Use register 2 for the operation. 0 equals add, 1 equals subtract, 2 equals multiply, 3 equals divide. B. Put the values to be acted on in registers 1 and 3. Thus, 306 would mean 3 plus 6, and 513 would mean 5 minus 3, and 425 would mean 4 times 5, and 933 would mean 9 divided by 3. Then put the results of the operation in registers 4 through 7 using register 4 for the sign, using 0 for positive and 1 for negative, and register 5 for the numerical answer, register 6 for any remainder in a case of division, and register 7 as an alarm, signaling a mistake in the input, either divide by 0 or an undefined operation in register 2. Notice that in this example, we are using the contents of registers, in each case a number, to stand for 4 very different things: a number, an arithmetical operation, the sign of a number, and an error flag. Secret 2. What a number in a register stands for depends on the program that we have composed. Using the building blocks we have already created, we can construct more impressive operations. With enough patience, we could draw the flow graph and write the program for squaring the number in register 7, or a program to find the average of the contents in registers 1 through 20, or factor the content of register 6, putting a 1 in register 5 if 5 is a factor, or compare the contents of register 3 and register 4 and put the larger content in register 5, unless it is exactly twice as large, in which case put a flag in register 7, and so forth. A particularly useful routine would search through 100 registers to see if any of them had a particular content, putting the number of that register's address in register 101. How would it work? Put the target number in register 102, and a copy of the target in register 103, zero out register 101, then, starting at register 1, subtract its contents from the contents of 103, after incrementing register 101. Looking for a zero answer. If you don't get it, go on to register 2 and so forth. If any register has the target number, halt. The address of that register will be in register 101. Thanks to the basic sensory power embodied in Deb, its capacity to notice a zero when it tries to decrement a register, we can turn the register machine's eyes in on itself so it can examine its own registers, moving contents around and switching operations depending on what it finds where. Secret 3. Since a number in a register can stand for anything, this means that the register machine can, in principle, be designed to notice anything, to discriminate any pattern or feature that can be associated with a number or a number of numbers. For instance, a black and white picture, any black and white picture, can be represented by a large bank of registers, one register for each pixel, with 0 for a white spot and 1 for a black spot. Now, write the register machine program that can search through thousands of pictures looking for a picture of a straight black horizontal line on a white background. Don't actually try to do it, life is short. Just imagine in some detail the difficult and hugely time-consuming process that would accomplish this. Once you've designed, in your imagination, your horizontal line recognizer, and your vertical line recognizer, and your semicircle recognizer, think about how you might yoke these together with a few dozen other useful discriminators and make something that could discriminate a capital letter A in hundreds of different fonts. This is one of the rather recent triumphs of computer programming, the optical character recognition, OCR software, that can scan a printed page and turn it quite reliably into a computer text file, in which each alphabetic or numerical symbol is represented by a number in ASCII code so that text can be searched and all the other wizardry of word processing can be accomplished by nothing but arithmetic. Can an OCR program read? Not really. It doesn't understand what is put before it. It sort of reads, which is a wonderfully useful competence that can be added to our bountiful kit of moving parts. Secret 4. Since a number can stand for anything, a number can stand for an instruction or an address. We can use a number in a register to stand for an instruction, such as add or subtract or move or search, and to stand for addresses, registers in the computer, so we can store a whole sequence of instructions in a series of registers. If we then have a main program, Program A, that instructs the machine to go from register to register, doing whatever that register instructs it to do, then we can store a second program, B, in those registers. When we start the machine running Program A, the first thing it does is to consult the registers that tell it to run Program B, which it thereupon does. This means that we could store Program A once and for all in the register machine's central processing unit in a reserved set of registers. It could be firmware burnt into the ROM, read-only memory, and then use Program A to run programs B, C, D, and so on, depending on what numbers we put in the regular registers. By installing Program A in our register machine, we turn it into a stored program computer. Program A gives our register machine the competence to faithfully execute whatever instructions we put, by number, into its registers. Every possible program it can run consists of a series of numbers in order that Program A will consult, in order, doing whatever each number specifies. And if we devise a system for putting these instructions in unambiguous form, for instance, requiring each instruction name to be the same length, say 2 digits, we can treat the whole series of numbers that compose the B program, say 86, 92, 84, 29, 08, 50, 28, 54, 90, 28, 54, 90, as one great big long number, 86928429085028549028549. This number is both the unique name of the program, Program B, and the program itself, which is executed one step at a time by Program A. Another program is 284-570-297598-752907-4829274902754-248-509-284-285-40423. And another is 890-829-64724900-284-952498-567-43390-438-204-59802-854-5447-896-53985. But most interesting programs would have much, much longer names, millions of digits long. The programs you have stored on your laptop, such as a word processor and a browser, are just such long numbers, many millions of binary digits long. A program that is 10 megabytes in size is a string of 80 million zeros and ones. Secret 5. All possible programs can be given a unique number as a name, which can then be treated as a list of instructions to be executed by a universal machine. Alan Turing was the brilliant theoretician and philosopher